Should we do a little quick testy testy?
Yeah.
Stop. Hello and welcome to a now weekly edition of Libero Podcast. I'm here with my giant Welsh friend, Matthew Pritchard.
Hello, hello.
Hello, Matthew Pritchard. And I am Chris Belmore. Still no Rich. He's on extended leave of absence. But
paternity leave.
Paternity leave, which apparently is going to be like several months. So good deal for him. But no worries. We're here and we'll crack on anyway. I guess there's probably only one place to start this week.
I think so. Straight with the Merseyside.
Everton scored lots of goals.
They did.
And Sunderland scored slightly fewer goals.
A third of the goals that Everton did.
I watched this, although I watched up until like 47 minutes and 20 seconds and then thought, right, I'm going to flick off now, go and make a cup of tea or whatever, and missed a goal. And then I started the second half quite late, and then I looked at the score and it was 5-2, and I was like, shit.
Wow, so you missed literally everything.
Missed five goals, but I caught them on match of the day, so no need to worry about that. It was a very strange game, actually. If you looked at the sort of shots and possession and things like that, it was actually all very even. Everton just very, very, very clinical.
It's kind of the flip side of where Sunderland found themselves last week. Having seen the North East Derby last week and having watched the first half of that, you'd think Newcastle would have hammered Sunderland. And it was kind of the flip side of that yeah. Sunderland then came away with, what, a 3-0 win?
Yeah, that was all hinging on that.
Yeah, I know, but it's...
Colasini red card.
It's a bit of a weird one for Sunderland, this. I think they would have seen...
It's not a Big Sam result, is it?
It's not a Big Sam result, but it wasn't a Big Sam team that he put out. Looking at the team, it looks like he set up with a 3-4-1-2. And with Wes Brown and Billy Jones as two of the three centre backs.
Yeah, well, because I put the formation in our running order, and I had it down as a 4-4-2 with Billy Jones at left back, and 4-3 with Billy Jones at left back and Van Aanholt playing left wing. I think that's just because Van Aanholt's positioning was so bad. Because you reckon it was actually more of a 3-5-2.
Yeah, well, I've seen the heat maps of this game, and basically Yedlin and Van Aanholt pretty much played as flat-out wingers.
Yeah.
Their average position is almost alongside the forwards on the right and left wings.
Which is, like, good if you're dominating the play.
Oh, yeah, 100%. It's amazing. I'm sure if they were dominating the play, Fletcher would have probably got, you know, four or five goals in this game.
But, I mean, it was interesting because Sunderland actually hit the posts twice in the first 15 minutes. I wouldn't say they were on top, but they looked the more likely to score. And then they just had a bit of a lapse of concentration, and it was Van Aanholt. And this is why I thought he was playing on the wing, because he was so far up the pitch. And De La Feu got in behind him, and Jones sort of didn't come across very quickly. And then they conceded. And then, like, literally 45 seconds later, exactly the same pattern of play happened, and De La Feu tried to cross it and didn't manage to do so.
De La Feu is such a key player for Everton on that right wing. He supplies so many crosses, which for somebody who came in as more of a forward player, Martin has really found a place for him on that wide right, supplying balls.
Didn't he cost 3 million as
well? Yeah, it's an obscene.
Can you imagine trying to find someone that good for 3 million?
The balls he supplies for someone like Lukaku is incredible, because it's not as if he just tosses the ball in towards the penalty spot and makes Lukaku go and kind of beat two centre-backs. He whips the ball and he plays them across the ground. He's a really, really good supply chain for Everton on the right, yeah. Especially with Coleman coming up alongside him as an attacking fullback.
Well, because interestingly, like I did the formation for Everton just as I thought, looking at the team sheet, and I had McCarthy and Barry kind of sitting, and then Barkley ahead, and then De La Feu on the right and Kone on the left. But actually, I think Barkley spent quite a lot of time out on the left, and Kone was really rampaging around in the middle. So I think it was probably like I've got it now as a 4-3-3 with Kone very narrow in behind Lukaku, but he was. It's pretty devastating. I mean, he obviously got a hat-trick, did an exceptional job. Some lovely link-up play with Lukaku, I thought, as well.
Yeah, I think he plays quite well, but I think most of those players in and around Lukaku do quite a good job of kind of playing off him, and they've got some quite good players. I think Naismith's been really good this season in a really similar role to what Kone plays.
Yeah.
Kind of in off the left-hand side. picking up what drops off either Lukaku or the defenders around him, and both of them seem to be picking up a lot of goals. You know, yeah. Naismith got that hat-trick against Chelsea, Kone got a hat-trick this week. You know, there's a lot to be said for sticking somebody who's got a real attacking flair and wanting to get in the box with someone like Lukaku up there. Because whatever ball you supply in there, if he doesn't get to it, one of the defenders is going to be under pressure to clear it.
Yeah, it's nice to see Lukaku. Like, he had a obviously a really good season two seasons ago, and then Everton bought him for all that money, 28 yeah. million. And he didn't have a terrible season, but he didn't have a great season. Everyone was, you know, well, not everyone, but some people were saying, you know, he wasn't worth it and stuff, but he's already got several goals this season. I mean, interestingly, watching this match, it was... You had Van Aanholt and Deulofeu were basically up against each other the whole match, and neither of them could be asked to track the other one.
Yeah.
And what it seemed to boil down to was that when Deulofeu went forward and with the players he had around him and stuff, it was just way more devastating and way more clinical than when Aanholt went forward and with the players that he had around him.
Yeah, I mean, Van Aanholt looks like a really good athlete, but somebody who's no one's taught me ever to defend.
Mm.
He looks like I've said this before, I think, that when Ashley Cole first came through, he was an incredible athlete with ridiculous speeds, but his defending wasn't really up to scratch, and his speed used to get him out of trouble in defence.
Yeah, but by the time he hit, like, 22,
yeah, yeah, and he'd been taken aside and somebody taught him to defend properly. And it looks like this is what Van Aanholt needs if he's going to actually step on, or if he doesn't kind of learn the art of defending, he's going to end up just falling back into, like, the lesser European leagues.
I mean, do you think this is weirdly, like, not too terrible a result for Big Sam because it gives him licence to go out and buy, you know, whoever he needs in January?
I don't know. It's a weird one with Sunderland. So it's a big job for Sam. And Sam's a big
man. They're back on the bottom of the table now.
They are. No, Villa won underneath them before tonight's game. It's a weird one because I think Sam has almost come in with he must have been given the remit, you can rip this whole thing up and start again in January, because he needs a whole new defence, really. There's nobody in that defence. Billy Jones, I think, in his actual position of right back, I think Billy Jones is a good middle of the table, middle lower half right back. He's solid, he's a good defender. But then, the centre-backs, they've got Brown, O'Shea, Coates,
I quite fancy, because I think what Big Sam will do is he'll get the... I know they've got Catamol and Mvia, but I think he'll get the... Sat just in front, sorry. But I think he'll get the unit playing a lot better, which actually means that people like O'Shea and Brown, as long as they have the requisite support close by, they'll probably tie him over. I don't think he'll necessarily be looking to go out and buy, like, three or four new centre-backs.
I think he needs a dominant centre-back. And he needs a left back.
Yeah.
Everything in front of him, I've never thought it's been that bad. You know, Catamol and Mvia are actually two quite good holding the field players. They get creativity from Johnson. They've got, you know, a couple of other players bouncing around.
Defoe hasn't actually been that good of late, but he also scored.
But he's a good finisher of the ball. So if you can get in possession, he will more often than not hit the target and score.
Yeah.
Fletcher's a good kind of big unit up front. So they've got the ways and means to get out of it. They've got to stop conceding goals first off.
Yeah, I think Big Sam will probably want maybe a bit more creativity in the middle of the park as well.
Yeah.
He likes to have, you know, while he wants it to be firm and solid, he likes to have players who are individually capable of like doing something.
So. This is why he loved Kevin Nolan so much. Kevin Nolan was the epitome of a solid player, but somebody who could create something from the centre field and get goals.
Fuck that! I want JJ Okocha back.
Yeah, or you a Djorkaeff. But you know he needs somebody because he's playing Adam Johnson at the moment in the centre of his attacking midfield, and that just doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean Everton they needed it. I mean, I guess most teams at the moment have been finding relief in Newcastle, Villa,
Sunderland. Bournemouth.
And Bournemouth. But I think Everton had a really tough month last month. They didn't beat Liverpool when Liverpool weren't doing great, and then they got spanked at Man U. They lost to Arsenal like 2-1. It was probably a bit more comfortable for Arsenal than that. They had a tough League Cup game that went to penalties against Norwich. So they really weren't picking up points at all in October. So they're kind of...
I'm hoping that Martinez can get the team together and go on a run now. He's got Stones and Coleman back fit. Leighton Baines is going to be back fit in January. So they've been waiting for him for a little while. And they've been playing, you know, two or three really young players in that back four. I think what we've got to remember is in October, they were missing Coleman, Stones... Jagielka and Leighton Baines for some of those, all in different parts.
Yeah, well, how long was Jagielka out for?
I don't know. But I know they were playing, you know, they'd two 19-year-olds at right back and left back for some of the time.
Because, like, obviously they had that tough month, Liverpool, Man United and Arsenal. But coming up, they've got West Ham, who are, you know, hit and miss.
Yeah.
And then they play Aston Villa and then they play Bournemouth. So you're probably expecting them like
six,
this,
five or
this
six
month
points
to pick
those.
Up 10 points in total, something close to that. So, yeah. Well, let's move on to the other... I mean, I thought it was probably the best game of the weekend, to be honest, which is a bit perverse to say with a 6-2. But West Brom versus Leicester, probably my favourite game. You said last week there was a game that was your favourite game of the season, but I think this is probably my favourite game of the season so far.
It's again, a really another odd result. Another team conceding a lot of goals with a manager who is normally typecast as not conceding a lot of goals.
Yeah, very, like, weird. I mean, you know, we know Leicester score.
Yeah,
freely.
But normally a Tony Pulis team doesn't concede more than one or two goals every game. And you go into a game here where they've lost 3-2 at home to, okay, a Leicester team that's in... They're really, really on form, and attacking-wise, Leicester are on fire. They're conceding a lot of goals, but if you're scoring as many as they are...
I mean, Vardy, again.
I know. What's that, eight in a row now?
Yeah, that's moved up to joint second now. We're probably going to keep talking about this. But Mahrez as well, like you said, he'd been rested. And I guess, like, you know, he's hit the ground running again, straight back into it.
He finds himself in weird positions. I'm never really sure what position Mahrez plays. And I should have probably had a look at like a heat map or something before this. But he finds himself in odd positions where he scores goals from. He's not necessarily a winger. He's not necessarily playing off the strikers. He seems to find himself just all over the place. Left-hand side, right-hand side. He scored one goal from literally the 6-yard box.
Yeah.
He seems to be a live wire that Ranieri says, you know, just go and... Go and play. If you're going to go and create and score goals, go and play.
Well, also, I was like joking last week that, you know, you had Vardy, who's really hitting form, and earlier on in the season, you had Mahrez, who's really hitting form. So next week, it's probably going to be Albrighton.
Yeah.
He had an absolutely stonking
He had a really
half.
Good game. Yeah.
And he plays a slightly weird position as well, because you'd probably have him down as a
winger.
Well, just a right winger, though.
Yeah.
Like a Navas type player. But he was on the left and he was kind of cutting inside and hitting in. You know, deep crosses. He picked up Mahrez for one of the goals, and I really like Mark Albrighton. I don't know what it is about him, but
yeah, he never seemed to come through at Villa. He never seemed to kind of kick on. He came through as a young player, played quite a lot of games for them, but they never really seemed to make a dent in their first team.
Yeah,
It's a bit of a weird.
I love him at Derby. Just I have to say that.
Yeah, of course. A bit of a weird one for West Brom. They're kind of in a bit of a weird situation, I think, or in a weird position, because if you look at their squad, it looks like it's been kind of pieced together with good Premiership players. People like, you know, Claudio Jakob, James Morrison, Chris Brunt, Johnny Evans. You know, there's good players in there, but without that much structure, they don't have fullbacks. They've got Chris Brunt playing left back and Craig Dawson playing right back.
Yeah.
One of them's a centre back, one of them's, you know, a utility midfielder.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think, again, you wonder whether Pulis will go out in January or maybe next summer and look to form a proper squad. Because I think what he did this summer was pick up a couple of players that he knew he needed. Someone like Rondon, he looked at maybe last season and thought, we don't score a lot of goals. We need somebody who's going to be a focal point.
Or Lambert as well.
Yeah. Somebody who's going to be a focal point and allow us to kind of get the ball at the pitch and score some goals, which he did with Rondon.
Yeah. I'd like to see Berahino played in a bit more of a striking role. He's a bit blunted out.
Yeah.
He's sort of basically playing as a defensive left midfielder under Pulis at the moment.
Well, when Pulis first came in, he went straight in with a 4-4-2 and played Rondon and Berahino, or Lambert and Berahino, straight up front. I think his first game was against, I think it was maybe Chelsea. And he played that for the first couple of games, if my memory serves me, and they got absolutely tanked.
Yeah.
But they're just getting overrun in midfield. So now he's gone back to, you know, a 4-2-3-1 or a 4-3-3, whichever way you want to look at it, with Darren Fletcher, Claudio Jakob,
and
James.
And Jakob, like,
yeah, yeah. It's two holders there, and then he allows the three players in front of them to go and play a little bit. So it's a bit more of a modern formation than 4-4-2. But like you said, you're losing out with a bit of Berahino by playing him out on the wing.
Yeah, and that's probably a bit down to the fact that also they don't have the fullbacks, like you said, bombing on, and it kind of means that he's doing a slightly different job. If he had someone behind him, it was a bit more adventurous, like, Van Aanholt. So he'd be even more defensive.
It's good to see Rondon scoring, I thought. He scored a fairly decent header.
Yeah, you're a bit of a fan of Rondon, aren't you?
Well, he seems to have just... I saw him play that first game against Chelsea, and he didn't seem that kind of perturbed by... I know we spoke about it last week in terms of big strikers coming into the Premiership and and you know not being fazed by big strong defenders or you know typecast big strong defenders, and he looks like he can handle it.
Yeah,
he's
a monster.
He is a big boy. Yeah, but he's picked up what three in ten games now. So yeah, I think hopefully he can be the person who solves kind of consistent goal scoring problems for West Brom, which they've kind of had for like 5 or 6 years, getting somebody constantly banging the goals in for them.
Yeah, I think like one of the major things with Leicester is like the fitness of the team, like Mahrez, Vardy, obviously, and then Albrighton and like Kante and Schlupp, and these guys are just relentless, and that's kind of borne out of just looking like apparently 15 of their last 17 goals have come in the second half.
Really?
And it's, you know, lots of those obviously involving comebacks and things like that, so it just seems like, you know, they're just... and just fitter.
Did you see Ranieri being this big a success for Leicester, honestly?
I don't think anyone saw it. Certainly not this immediate. He's obviously like a very decorated manager.
Yeah, but he'd been away from the Premiership for quite a long time.
Well, I think if you go back and you look at our podcast around the time, people probably thinking like, he's not that good a fit. He's going to play like way more defensive tactics. Yeah. He's not going to have a settled team and the squad's not really big enough or high quality enough for that to, you know... for him to tinker as much as perhaps he likes to do, but fair play to him.
So would you, you know, quick hat on it, where do you see Leicester going? Do you see them falling away, or do you see them kind of sticking around top six, top eight?
No, I think they'll fall away. I think they'll probably end up finishing maybe 11th or 12th, somewhere like
that. Which is a good season
for them. Which is a solid season. I don't think they'll be really troubling Europe. I think they'll probably finish maybe 5-6 points off a European spot. But yeah, somewhere around there. But that's an excellent first season.
That is because what they just escaped last year. So yeah. any kind of flirting with mid table is a good second season in the Premiership.
Yeah, and they had a pretty major upheaval. Like yeah. It wasn't like it was a smooth handing over.
No,
and, you know, it was just happened. Well, so obviously Leicester in their second season, a team doing pretty well in their first season so far. Watford 2-0 against West Ham. West Ham displaying that baffling inconsistency that they seem to have. But one person who is not at all inconsistent is Ighalo up front.
Yeah, absolutely on fire. I had no idea this game was going to go this way. I bet my Super 6 and my betting went with West Ham with a kind of slim away win.
You can never trust West Ham.
You know, I thought they've been brilliant on the road so far this season, so I thought maybe sneak a 1-0 or 2-1. You know, Watford have been really good. They haven't conceded... I think the last time I looked at the stats, they've conceded the least amount of goals in the bottom half of the Premiership.
Yeah.
Which is amazing for a team that's just come up. They seem really organised. If you look at their team, there's nobody in that team you'd scream, you know, definitely Premiership quality.
I'd say Capu.
Yeah, but Gomez, I think, is a good shot stopper. Yeah. He had a couple of ricks when he played at Spurs. But, you know, Capoue is pretty good. But then,
I think that, what's his name? Is it Nathan Ake? I think, isn't he a Chelsea?
He is. I think he's on loan from Chelsea. And they've got quite high hopes for him as either a left-back or a centre-back. But, Ighalo, whenever you come up into the Premiership, every team looks for a goal scorer.
Yeah.
And normally you see teams going out and buying really obscene European players, trying to hope that one of them will land on his feet and get 10 goals, 15 goals. Because you always talk about when you come up into the league, you need somebody who's going to score you 10 or 15 goals.
How old do you think he is?
26.
Oh, damn it, I was going to say a bit younger than that. Yeah, it's interesting because he was obviously on loan last season from Watford in their promotion push, and he did okay. Like, he didn't really get that involved, but he scored maybe 3 goals or something like that. And then Udinese, he was on loan, and then they terminated his loan and signed him on the same day. So they obviously had an agreement with Udinese, and Udinese actually released him on a free, so they picked him up on
with
the free.
With the same owners.
Yeah.
It's the same family.
Yeah,
it's
the family. I mean, like, I know they've moved people between clubs in terms of loans, but they've never done it as, like,
blatantly as that.
Yeah. Right.
But, I mean, you know, looking at his form last season, I mean, you know, we spoke about Troy Deeney last week saying that the odds, everyone went for him or Callum Wilson, their fancy football teams. Because my thought was that if Watford are going to stay up, they're going to need Deeney to be hammering the goals. He got his first last week, and what's Ighalo got now? Ighalo's got seven already.
Well, I think I'm right in saying this. He's already Watford's all-time leading Premier League goal scorer. So they obviously haven't spent that long in the Prem.
No.
The last time they're in the Prem was 06-07, and before that, 99-2000. Any guesses for who their previous top goal scorers were? Looking at my code, trying to...
Not a clue.
Well, 0607 was Hammer Buatsa, remember him?
Okay, yeah.
Who had seven as well. And then before that, it was someone who I think I probably remember more fondly than I should, Heide Helgesen.
Yeah, okay. Heide, yeah. That's
he had six. But I was looking because no one in the 99-2000 team or squad was in the squad for 0607. So I know that he matched their all-time season tally, but I think he's also now their top goal scorer as well.
Wow.
Which is pretty decent going. It's pretty decent going for a promoted November. Team for November.
Yeah, that'll do. That'll do. But West Ham, I don't know. This is going to be West Ham season. I think they're going to absolutely baffle people for the rest of the season. They've had ridiculous away games where they've gone and beaten Arsenal, Man City, and then they go away to Watford in a game you expect them to at least get a point out of.
Yeah.
And they just didn't look at the races at all.
But the thing is, what do you think is more likely for them? For them to stop having the games where they like tank it and like just go completely off the rails and concede, or for them to stop having games where they play brilliantly in scoring? And I think it's the latter.
Yes.
Which kind of, you know, I don't think they're in trouble, but I think maybe
that would be a worry.
Maybe, like, I was just saying Leicester, maybe I'd expect them to finish top of the bottom half.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be that shocked if West Ham finished below them, even after the start that they've had.
Yeah, because you're only going to play your Arsenals, Man City's, Man U, Chelsea 8 times a season. You've then got to play the rest of the league.
Yeah, you mean the games where they're up for it enough to win.
Yeah, exactly.
They're easy wins. Yeah.
The games, you don't need motivating to go to Old Trafford and try and beat Man U. You don't need motivating to go to the Emirates and try and beat Arsenal.
Yeah.
Or you shouldn't anyway, but you shouldn't be motivating for any of these games. But you know what I mean? You naturally are up for going to Old Trafford and trying to pick up a win.
Yeah.
At home to Bournemouth.
Also, they keep getting players sent off. That's they do keep getting players.
Yeah. I mean, they need to find a replacement for James Collins. I think they need Winston Reid back pretty sharpish. I'm not sure how James Collins is even still in a Premiership football team.
Well, maybe James Collins could be one of those players that Big Sam signs. He seems like a Big Sam.
That's not going to solve Sunderland's problems. They've got two of those ready. They've got Wes Brown and John O'Shea. So, yeah, they don't need any more kind of really old, slow...
I mean, if they, like, an injury or like, Dimitri Payet stops scoring...
I think if Payet stopped creating and scoring goals, I think they could be in serious trouble.
That's what I mean. I just think they could have way more games where, at the moment, they're really up for it and they're kind of getting these fantastic wins, but I don't know if I can see that happening again and again and again, so I fancy them to tail off a bit, but we'll see.
Yeah, I hope not, because I really want to see West Ham go into next season, A, in the Premiership, which I don't think they're in any danger of going down. But I think it would be nice to see a successful West Ham in the Olympic Stadium, simply because the Olympic Stadium looks like such an awesome venue. To see it packed out next year at West Ham, I think it'd be really, really good.
Yeah, you want the first game of the season next year to be like Chelsea at home.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it'd be absolutely rammed with mental East Londoners.
Yeah. Well, on that note, why don't we have a... a quick shift over to halftime.
Yeah, sounds good.
We've got another top five that we're going to talk about. I believe this one was yours. Would you like to introduce it?
So this is a bit of a flip on the top five, slightly negative on that. It's top
a
five.
A bit of a moaning top five this week.
Top five worst players to get England caps. Do you want to rock in straight where we go, number five?
All right, well, worst. So yeah, my fifth worst player. So, and we're talking about like worst quality, not like worst human.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, although some of them are similar. I'll probably start with Brian Deane.
Nice.
Like, okay, Premiership striker.
Scored the first ever Premiership goal.
Yeah, I remember that.
And what are you putting him as your top five worst England internationals?
Two of his three caps were against New Zealand.
Okay.
He didn't score.
Tricky. Which is fine for a goalkeeper.
I mean, you've got three caps. One of them is against Spain, but two games against New Zealand. And this is like 1990s New Zealand as well. You've got to be. So
you're
Brian Deane, fifth. Yours.
Mine is Alan Thompson.
Okay.
Which is a proper retro shout of a footballer. I absolutely loved Alan Thompson.
The Celtic Alan Thompson.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But before that, it was Bolton Alan Thompson.
I remember
and
lots
Aston
of
Villa.
Lots of shouts for him to be in the squad later on.
Because he was English and he had a left foot.
Yeah.
Which I'll come on to.
And Graham Rousseau was injured or something.
I loved Alan Thompson. He was he came through that Bolton team that were kind of just really underrated. And then he went to Villa. Didn't do a lot of Villa for quite a long time. And then went to Celtic. He was, I think at the time, he was the first... the first ever Celtic player to get an England cap.
Really?
Yeah. And that England cap was against Sweden in 2004.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm trying to go back through it. And I can't really think of...
Fraser Forster's the only one who's done it since. So yeah. There's only ever been two Celtic players to have England caps.
He's fallen off a cliff, hasn't he, Fraser Forster? Anyway.
Well, he's injured.
Okay, that'll be why then.
Your number four.
My number four... well, not that dissimilar to Fraser Forster. Richard Wright. Not that dissimilar because he's a goalkeeper as well. No, but very
Arsenal legend.
Very high hopes of him from very early on. I mean, he came through at Ipswich and he had 240 appearances for Ipswich, something like that, before he... And I think he left them when he was about 24, 25.
Yeah, he signed for Arsenal for Ipswich.
Went for Arsenal. Played, like, I think about 13, 14 games for you, and then went to Everton. Had one good season at Everton. Yeah. And then they signed Tim Howard and that was the end of that. But then since then, like, basically since he left Ipswich, he had 140 appearances before he left Ipswich, before the age of 24. And then he had 140 appearances in the following 15 seasons.
Well, he's been at City. I think he's still at City.
Yeah, yeah, he is. He's just never played.
He's in their squad. He's been in the squad for, like, last five, six years.
I mean, it's so weird. Like, he's good enough to be back up at somewhere like City, but he just doesn't, I don't know, maybe he just doesn't have the drive or something. But he has an England cap.
Yeah. Well, I remember when he came to Arsenal, he was really highly sought after. He was really highly thought of.
Yeah.
I always thought at Arsenal he was too small.
Always really good on champ. Richard Wright?
Yeah.
He's not small, is he? He's a giant.
I always thought he was quite small.
All right, well, I'm going to look that fact up while you hit me with your number four.
To keep on a trend, a left-footed... England winger or wing back cum winger, Steve Guppy, another player who at the time was, I think this is when Leicester were doing pretty well under Martin O'Neill.
Yeah,
he had a left foot that he could use and knew how to attack. So I think you either played him on the left wing or left wing back for quite a while. Oddly enough, fact fans. Only footballer to have played for England under-21s, England semi-pro, England B, and the full England team.
That means he shouldn't be on this list at all. If he's got all that, and he's that good a trivia answer.
But if he only played for each of those once.
Interesting. Is that true, though?
It's not true.
Okay, well then, that's a really useless point.
It is completely useless, but so is Steve Gapping.
Richard Wright, 6'2", which I know is small for you,
yes,
but big for the
small.
Rest of us. okay, so my number three, Michael Ricketts. Bolton legend, Michael Ricketts.
Yeah.
So this is just a strange one. I think like the way I'd have to describe it looking back is he had a good season for Bolton in 2001 and kind of, I think he got about 20 goals or something in their promotion campaign, which was quite decent. And he came up into the Prem and he got 12 in 37. And he was still quite young at this stage, so
yeah,
it was pretty promising. But it was that phase just after Sven had come in. That, you remember the first like year and a half? And he was just trying everyone.
Where he used every English player in the Premiership and English
leagues.
Yeah,
and we loved it at first because we were like, oh, he's not just going on and picking the big name players. He's giving everyone a go. But some of those decisions were just absolutely mad.
Was Michael Bridges around the same era as this?
Well, similar ages, I would guess. I'm just trying to think back. But like this England cap just absolutely ruined him. He played like just before the 2002 World Cup, so we, a little bit of a, like, England fans were thinking, we're not going to take Ricketts, surely.
Get him on the plane.
And then after that, like, he really just tumbled down the leagues. And I think I was looking at his stats earlier, and I think he played nearly 200 games after that. As he fell down the leagues and scored 33 goals, which is about 1 in 6. So going from England player to a 1 in 6 player in League Two, probably not good enough to have played for England.
No.
Your number three.
My number three, again, on a very, very similar to your number three, is Jay Bothroyd. Probably more recent than yours.
Yeah, I wonder, like, because part of me thinks that's a little bit harsh, but I'm sure I'll look back on it with the same, like...
I wouldn't have thought so. He was the first England player to play for England. In 2010, he was the first English league player to play for England. Since Nugent, which is only 3 years
earlier.
You mean
earlier. Not outside the top division?
Yeah, sorry, outside the top division. Since the Nugent in 2007. And he was the first English international to be playing for Cardiff City in 111 years of their history.
Wow.
And he was just average. I remember seeing him come on.
It was him and Ricky Lambert was it Roy who was looking at
Yes, it was, yeah, in 2010. It was just, he was doing okay in the Championship, but he was doing okay in the Championship for Cardiff City. At no point was he ever going to be good enough in 2010 to get in England's international team, especially not to go to a tournament.
He fucking scored the goal that stopped us getting promoted the other season.
He did.
Bastard. Okay, I'll go in with my number two, which hurts me to say it because he's a bit of a Derby legend.
He's a Derby legend.
Seth Johnson. We were playing absolute shit at the time. And I think we were...
Was this not when he was playing for Leeds?
No, this is when he was playing for
Leeds. Really?
And we were bottom of the league. And I think he'd been getting...
What, in the Premiership?
Yeah,
I think, he'd, bottom
I think
of the league.
He'd been getting booked. Glossing over. I think he'd been getting booked like a fair few times as well. So it was really bizarre that he got his call-up. But he almost scored with his very first touch. Because I remember sitting watching at home with my brother and my dad. And we were like... bizarre that he'd come on, but obviously cheering for him. And then he literally, against Gigi Buffon, the best keeper in the world, and it took a properly... He kind of got put through and he was charging straight at him, connected with it, like probably just past the penalty spot, and Buffon managed to save it. And it was like, could have been, and that was all there ever was from Seth Johnson.
I'm pretty... That's a good summary of his career.
What a high, though. What a high.
Yeah, and then just tumble down lows from there with his shonky knees. Speaking of lows, my number two is Danny Mills.
Wow.
Danny Mills was an
okay... Worst ever player?
No, because I've got number one coming afterwards. but even Danny Mills was an average Premier League right back.
Yeah.
But when in 2002, when Gary Neville got injured, again, I can't remember Gary Neville really getting injured that often. It was just seemed to be unlucky that it was around the 2002.
I'm trying to remember who else must have been a right back. Like Carragher?
Yeah, but Carragher, he wouldn't play right back for England. He would only play centre back. That was right at the same time.
Was that?
But Danny Mills went to the 2002 World Cup because Neville was injured. He played every minute of England's five World Cup games.
Really?
I think in the quarterfinal he'd have been marking Ronaldinho.
Eesh.
Best of luck. But in his 19 caps, he never played at Wembley.
Wasn't it? Ronaldinho stamped on him to get sent off.
Really?
Yeah. Fair play, Ronaldinho.
In his 19 caps, he didn't play at Wembley once.
Really?
Which you've got to look back and think, shit.
That's good one.
That's pretty brutal.
Why is that?
Five of them were in the World Cup. Actually, I don't know if around that time wasn't when Wembley has been rebuilt, perhaps. I'll check my stats next time. But never played at Wembley in 19 caps.
Wow. I'm just trying to look at who else might have been a right back around that time.
Wes Brown.
Yeah. That's probably about it, to be honest.
So England weren't exactly rich with right backs. Yeah, right wing back.
All right. And then, to my number one. This one I say with a bit of a heavy heart. Steve Bull.
It's a bully.
Like,
I don't know if that was a nickname issue.
I think he might have been the worst player ever to play for England, but he was actually, like, in terms of his God-given talents.
Yeah.
But he was actually really effective. I think he was the old Division 3 or Division 2, the third tier, whatever it would have been called at the time, when he got called up, and it was Bobby Robson era. And it was before the 1990 World Cup.
Right.
And he got a debut goal against Scotland. Fair play. And then in the next time, he... I think it was his next outing, even. Scored two against Czechoslovakia. One of them was an absolute belter. I think it's been voted in England's top 50 goals of all time. And he ended up scoring 4 and 13, which is, you know,
fair. Decent.
And he went to 1990 World Cup, and he was...
He'd been playing behind Gary Lineker. So it's not as if he'd have been starting games. To score 4 and 13, some of them, if not all of them, would have been...
like in the hole.
But he'd been up against Lineker, Beardsley.
Yeah.
So it's not as if he was starting and playing 90 minutes.
So he was a sub in the first three games, and then he played, he started the fourth game, which I think was against the Netherlands, I want to say. Reasonable 1990 World Cup, 4 goals in 13 for, you know, someone in the third, he was in the third tier of English football when he got his first cap. So on talent, probably the worst player, but looking at my list, by far the highest achiever, like with what he had to work with. So slight curveball, as I like to do. But
So my number one worst player to have an England cap, the original fox in the box, Francis Jeffers.
This is just more Arsenal hatred.
It is. It's a little bit kind of weighted to the
worst £11 million Arsenal player to play for.
I think he might have been 9, but still a shower of shit. again, kind of, he came from really good crop. He was, he's, I think he still holds the goal scoring record for the under 21s with Alan Shearer, which is a pretty decent start. Most players who do well at under 21 level tend to do quite well at international level.
Yeah. You know, I think Shock Lineker was in the under-21s for that long to hold the scoring record, I guess.
But you look at, I think Gareth Barry or James Milner is still the under-21 appearances holder because they played around there for so long. It's normally, if you do well in 21s, you normally come through the England squad.
Well, Milner came through at the same time as Rooney, but he... He stuck around the 21s. Whereas Rooney pretty much went straight into the first team for England.
So oddly enough, Franny Jeffers, in his one cap, he scored against Australia.
Yeah.
And it was the same game where Rooney made his debut. Rooney came off the bench for the start of the second half with Francis Jeffers.
Nice. And when James Milner was still in the under-21s.
Yes.
I think that's a bit harsh. Also looking, I think mine is more of a balanced five-a-side team than yours. Richard Wright, and then you've got Seth Johnson snapping everyone's heels, and then you've got Steve Ball with his magical dribbling.
You've got three strikers in the midfielder.
Brian Deane and Ricketts. Yeah, but Seth's a monster. He'll kill anyone.
No, I don't think so.
And I've got a legit keeper who never plays.
I haven't got a goalkeeper.
All right, cool. We'll leave it there. We'll go to half time, and we'll be back in a bit.
Jenis with a cross. Oh, terrific goal by Jeffers. England are back in the international. The combination of Jermaine Jenis and Francis Jeffers brings England a goal.
Welcome back. So after some rest and some cheeky half-time oranges, we're back for the second half. We're going to kick off the second half by going to West London, where shit keeps on flowing downhill.
Shit. That would be uphill because the Thames actually flows.
Shit keeps on flowing downhill
right.
To West London.
Okay.
Chelsea 1, Liverpool 3.
It looked like it was going to be all okay for them.
It did. It started so well. I sat and watched this with my brother-in-law. Fourth or fifth minute, whenever it was, Ramirez pops up and all was well with the world. Liverpool started with an odd formation that you couldn't really see them getting anything out of the game with. Chelsea were dominant in the first kind of 15-20 minutes, and you thought, okay, they got an early goal, go on and really take this Liverpool team apart, a bit based on the fact that Liverpool hadn't looked that good in the last three games. They'd run around a lot but not really got that many good results. So you're thinking, if Chelsea got on the hop a bit here, they could really get into Liverpool.
Well, because I was I think I was on a train or something in the first, actually I was going to see Rich, And when I got to his house, I because he'd been watching the game, and I got to his house and I asked him, like, how has it been all Chelsea so far? And he was like, no, it's been all Liverpool so far.
Well, after about 15-20 minutes, it completely flipped on its head. And then from then on, Liverpool just completely controlled the game.
Because they had something like 58% possession at the end of the first half or something. They're absolutely dominant. I think that was Chelsea's only shot on target in the first half.
Yeah, again, Chelsea just...
maybe even in the game.
They started so quickly and then went so quickly back into their shell. As soon as Liverpool got on the ball and got more possession, Chelsea's confidence just completely shot again.
Yeah. It was interesting to see Firmino starting up front.
I think it's been... I don't think Benteke was fit. I've got to be honest. I couldn't have seen Benteke... I couldn't have seen Firmino start in this game.
He was fit enough to be on the bench, and he came on after what?
He had half an hour.
60 minutes.
Yeah, he had half an hour. But you can be fit for half an hour and not fit for 90.
Yeah.
But in essence, you know, we spoke about this last week. It shows what you can do when you've got two completely different attacking options to play. Because again, Firmino played as almost a false nine in the first 60 minutes, which meant that, you know, Terry and Cahill didn't really have anybody to mark. They were more zonal marking.
Yeah.
And you do wonder if that kind of worked in Liverpool's favour for Coutinho's first goal. Because if you look at what happened with Coutinho's first goal, he got the ball kind of just on the edge of the 18-yard box.
Yeah.
And in Chelsea's formation, they've got Mikel and Ramirez.
Well, I mean, it seems like all three of the goals are a bit like this.
Yeah, but you've got Mikel and Ramirez, who are meant to be shielding Terry and Cahill.
Yeah.
Basically, Coutinho gets on the ball. Ramirez comes flying across to block him. Coutinho, quick drag back, and you're expecting Mikel to be there because that's the role. They should be working in tandem in the centre of that midfield.
Or you're expecting one of the three in front of those two to have come back, which obviously isn't happening.
But when they panned out on the wider view, you can actually see Ramirez comes flying across the block, Coutinho, and Mikel has wandered back in the middle of the centre back, and he's actually behind John Terry.
Really?
So as John Terry comes flying out to throw himself, as he does, at Coutinho.
There's a lot of John Terry sliding around in this game.
But you look back and Mikel suddenly just dropped behind Terry, thinking, actually, as Coutinho turns back onto his left foot, that should be where Mikel is kind of working in parallel with Ramirez.
It was a great finish. It was lovely to see him hit it with his left foot as well.
Yeah, like, it was.
He's usually more associated, obviously, with his right from a similar sort of place, maybe even a bit further.
He had a really good game. He had a really, really good game. I do wonder if he had a bit more space, because essentially there were four of them rotating around positions behind or around Ramirez and Mikel.
Also because Chelsea are just shit is another reason for
that. A little bit. But I wonder if there's a little bit more freedom for him just to go and find space. Yeah. And like you said, the second goal he scored was almost a carbon copy.
Well, he's a very Klopp player, and he's incredibly hardworking. He's pacey, he's good on the ball.
It's like Goethe. It's kind of what it's kind of what Klopp did with Goethe when he had him at Dortmund.
Yeah. Yeah, so or even Royce, I'd say.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Royce started out as a winger, and now he's number 10, really. It was only Coutinho's the second game he scored in. He hasn't actually scored since the opening day of the season. Remember, he had the... They thought it got given at the time, but it was actually proved to be offside afterwards.
Oh, against Bournemouth?
Yeah.
Yeah. Coutinho had a really good game, but I think... again, looking at Chelsea, I just don't know what's going on there. Hazard got taken off after, I think it was 60 minutes or 50 minutes. He got taken off for Kennedy.
Yeah.
Instantly, Kennedy looked livelier. They played a ball down the inside of the two centre-backs, inside Klein and Skrtel, and Kennedy was onto it and got a shot just off target. And Hazard didn't do that in the first 50, 60 minutes. He looks like an absolute shell of the player he was last year. I don't know what's going on there, but they've tried him, like we spoke about last week, they've tried him as a 10, they've tried him on the left wing. He just doesn't seem to be functioning anywhere within that team.
No, it's just weird. It's just like it seems like it's too much to say he's just out of form, because he doesn't really seem to be contributing anything. At least like last season, he was the most fouled player, and he'd offer a lot of relief for the team.
Yeah.
Even if you took away his goals, he'd be performing an important role.
But we were talking last week, and it's not as, sorry, I was talking with my brother-in-law this weekend, and we were saying it's not as if his levels dropped to he's just not as effective as he was last year. Now he's just not affecting the game at all.
Yeah.
He's not. Last season he was dominating games, and he was the best player on the pitch every game.
Well, and there were some games where it just looked like Chelsea weren't going to be able to get through and just do something.
Whereas this season he's not even affecting the game, let alone running it as he was last year.
Yeah. Very true.
I've had a bit of a think about this, and I wonder whether...
I mean, I'm excited about this comment that you've written here.
I wonder whether it's time for Chelsea to just he's tried a couple of things. He's dropped Ivanovic, moved Zouma to right back, he's dropped Terry, he's brought Terry back in. For this game, he dropped Matic and Fabregas.
Yeah.
He's dropped Hazard once or twice this season. I think it might be time for him to just change the formation. He's been going in predominantly with 4-2-3-1.
Yeah.
And they're just conceding too many goals, and they're not scoring enough. So I think he needs to kind of bring it back to the root of the problem. Is they can't win games by outscoring other teams. They need to stop the other teams scoring as many goals.
Yeah, it makes sense. It's what you'd expect Big Sam to do at Sunderland.
Yeah, so I think he needs to go back to a formation that worked really well for him when he first came into English football, is having kind of a more standard 4-3-3 and having a midfield three of Matic holding as Makalele did, having Ramirez as kind of SCN role, his legs and really getting around the pitch, and then Fabregas working as Lampard did. I think that would be a more solid three in front of...
None of those players you mentioned is as good as the players that you mentioned.
No, they're not. But it's more a formation shift than a like-for-like personality. I think it would give him more stability. It would give him a bit more... Definitely more possession.
The other thing is shield. Like that you had like Robin and Duff or whoever else was around at that time who were just beating players on their own. Obviously, you had Drogba up front. Like, I don't know. This team... I mean, obviously, it's not as good as some of the old Chelsea teams that were just dominated.
But then you've got... If you then put a team together with Willian, Hazard and Costa up front, you know, you've got... You're replacing Drogba, Robin and Def with Costa, Hazard and
Willian.
I mean,
anything's got to be worth a try at this moment in time.
I'm just thinking it might be just worth going back and just saying, right, let's stop conceding goals. Let's start winning games 1-0.
You've got his number. Just give him a text.
Yeah. Well done.
I'll
tweet him. I'm sure you'll love that.
Lucas was a very lucky boy.
Very lucky boy. I didn't think so at the time, but looking back on reflection,
there were four or five, like, after he was booked.
Yeah, he got away with, I think he had two or three, and then he was booked, and then he had one, and then he had this foul on, I think it was Ramirez, or I think it was William, was it?
No, I think it was Ramirez.
You can't make those challenges if you're on your cards. On the halfway,
Ramirez went past him and he stuck out a leg way too late and just cleaned him up.
Yeah. On the halfway line as Ramirez is breaking towards it. It's a yellow card. I argue.
Well, he also did that thing where he looked up and he was like appealing, but he didn't really believe it. He was shit scared he was going to get
at the time. I thought it was a first yellow, but maybe not a second yellow. But I think on reflection, as a totting up process, I think he'd had enough fouls to make that a second yellow card.
I'm surprised he didn't get taken off.
Well, I couldn't believe it because then Milner got taken off for Benteke. When I saw Benteke warming up, I assumed he would come on for Lucas and then they would move Milner back into the central role and Firmino out onto the right. But he came on for Milner and they left Lucas on for the entire game because Chan had also been booked.
It's interesting because who else have they got that's like a destroyer like that?
Well, the closest they would have would be someone like Jordan Rossiter, who is really young.
I mean, Chan is, he's a bit classier than that, isn't
he? Yeah, he is. Joe Allen's the only other centre-back they've really got. But again, he's
defensive midfielder, he's more of a...
So they don't really have
Leon
one.
Britain clone.
If they had to take him off, they'd have had to have changed the system. So I wonder if he kept him on and just told him to stop making stupid challenges.
Mm. And then it goes, I guess it goes back to kind of what you're talking about before, last week when Milner got taken off and Benteke came on, and it's just a different thing. They've gone through 60 minutes not having to mark anyone, the two Chelsea centre-backs. And now suddenly, like, you've got Benteke, and it's just, as you say, it's a complete switch of mindsets and everything to, like, have to adjust to that.
And the first thing they did was Liverpool, Saka got the ball at his feet and just pinged the ball right up to Benteke on a diagonal ball, and he won the ball, and
neither Terry nor Cahill, and certainly not Aspilicueta are that big, I guess, and he was steering clear of Zuma, who's got a massive leap on him.
It's a really good win, and for Klopp to get his first win in the league away at Chelsea, I think it will do a massive amount for his confidence in that team.
Yeah, I think it'll look back on it and like it'll be remembered as a bigger deal than it was, because it would be strange to think that Chelsea was so shit in this period of time. But I mean, all right, cool. Well, I guess probably need to talk about your beloved Arsenal. A very flattering result for them. I thought so.
I think we've held off for long enough. 3-0 away at the Liberty Stadium.
I love Key. He's such a good player. I love the way he plays the game. Like, his passing is always so positive. He doesn't really give the ball away that much. And he does... The thing that I think about midfield players, particularly like people who aren't fast and who are passers, is they play passes I didn't even see, even though I have a much better vantage point. And in this game, there were probably four or five passes that he played that I just didn't even see that they were on.
I do wonder, looking at their formation, whether him and Xavi can play in the same team. They both like to get on the ball. They both like to pass the ball forward, which is great. Neither of them you could see breaking up an attack. Yeah. They both intercept balls. They both get on the ball, but neither of them. We just talk about Lucas being a destroyer.
Yeah, disruptor.
Yeah, a disruptor destroyer. Neither Xavi or Key really, I think, give that defence any solidarity behind
them. I think
them.
They can totally play in the same team, and against teams where they're going to dominate possession a bit more, Arsenal's probably not the game for it. What I would say is I don't know whether Xavi, Key and Sigurdsson can play together a lot, because that is not a particularly...
Heavyweight midfield?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, they're all quite big, but it's not a particularly, like...
No.
There's no tackling,
I think Swansea have had a tricky kind of month. Or a tricky 6 weeks, because Gomez now hasn't scored in 7 or 8 games, and really there's nothing on the bench that's really going to be a foil for him.
What's the guy they got from? Did he come from Benfica?
Edezito
or something.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't look like he's going to be ready for another 18 months. He looks really raw. He looks big.
He's not young though. He's about 26.
Yeah, but he looks quick. He looks big, but he doesn't look like he's ready for the Premiership. Yeah. Whereas Gomez landed on his feet and scored some goals really, really quickly, but they just seem to have dried up for him completely. And same for Ayew. Ayew, I know, popped up, I think it was last week or the week before with a couple, but I don't know, it's a bit shaky down there.
They look a good team, though.
They're still a good team, and they'll still finish
top
10.
Yeah,
but I think this will be a disappointing result for them, I think.
Did you think it was a foul on Fabianski?
Yes. Although, And every day of the week, I think that's a foul.
I thought it was one of those where the keeper expects it to be a foul, and they put themselves in a position where it's easy for
the ref
them to look like they've been fouled. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. There's like a certain body shape where you just have to look like you're reaching over a player and you don't quite get to the ball. And that's like better than not going for it at all because you know you're going to get a foul. Yeah. Except when you don't, it's not better. Yeah. It's nowhere near.
I thought it was a blatant free. I was amazed it wasn't a free kick. Koscielny, you could just see backing him. But I know Koscielny was always looking at the ball, but he also knows exactly what's been coming behind him. He knows Fabianski well enough to know Fabianski.
All he's done is stood his ground. It's not like he's jumped backwards.
No, he hasn't. But I think that's almost worse. Had he gone backwards and jumped straight up for the ball, it would have been almost better because he's competing for the ball. He didn't get off the floor. He just kept on going backwards and backwards and backwards.
See, I think then he has clattered the keeper and he's jumped and he's out of control of his body and all that other stuff that you normally associate with the foul. I don't think it was.
I thought it was.
I don't think it was a blatant foul, put it that way. Like, I know that they've obviously been given.
Good finish, though.
He didn't, because he said in his post-match interview, like, he didn't really know what happened.
No.
And Giroud shouted at him, like, you can score. And that's what, and so he turned and tucked it into the net. So Giroud assist, I think we'll give that one down to
him. Yeah, I'm enjoying Arsenal more so every week.
You're enjoying Joel Campbell?
Yeah, this was I was a bit worried when we lost the Ox and Theo. And we've managed again to rack up without really noticing a shitload of injuries. Yeah, which is good.
Apparently, you're going to call back with a German kiddie from West Brom. What's his name?
Gnabry.
Sergio Gnabry.
Yeah, which Tony Pulis doesn't rate him, and he's been quite open in saying he's not good enough for West Brom's first team.
He's an Arsenal winger.
When he's played for us, he's looked really good.
I think it's really unlucky because Oxlade-Chamberlain was starting to make that position look like it might be his because Theo doesn't want it.
No.
Theo seems to have accepted that he'll play less if he can have a proper tussle with Giroud.
Yeah, which is, before they were getting injured, it was doing the best for both Giroud and Walcott because they seemed to be pushing each other on. And like I said, when the Ox finally got that spot in the right wing, I think everybody in England wanted him to have a run free of injury because when he's had a run in the first team and he's been injury free, you've seen he's a top quality player, but he just seems to pick up injuries, and it's another one where we say he's 3 weeks out but could quite easily be 2 months.
I think the best thing probably that's happened to Arsenal this season is just the sheer consistency of the back six.
Yeah,
you just know who it's going to be every time. And like, I know Cazorla played a lot of games in that sort of withdrawn midfielder role last season, particularly when Coquelin came back. But he also played a lot of games where he's on the left, on the right, and he was moving around a lot. Whereas now it's like, okay, we can get Santi in, we can get Erdelin, we can get Sanchez in, we can have whichever striker we want, and then we've still got the other option, whether it's Oxlade-Chamberlain or Joel Campbell or whoever it needs to be. Like, Santi changing his game to be able to play that sort of game, what a genius.
Since he's moved back into that kind of almost deep-lying playmaker role, It's completely changed Arsenal because we've not been forcing Ramsey or Wilshere. Obviously, Wilshere's been injured, but he seems to be more intelligent than those two to be able to play that and kind of curb his natural instinct to attack.
Yeah.
Because when we've played Wilshere there, when we've played Ramsey there, we've been caught short.
He does go forward, though,
but I think he picks and chooses his moments better because he knows he isn't the quickest. I think he might have just had a bit better game awareness than Ramsey or Wilshere playing that role.
The other thing that I think is a sort of linked to that is, I don't know whether it's been like Wenger's said this has got to happen or it's just naturally happened, but obviously Coquelin's come in, so he's going to sit deeper. Santi's moved back, and as you say, he's either curbing or being told to curb, whatever the result is. I also think Sanchez, last season, because he was scoring so many goals, he was kind of playing wherever he wanted to, and he wasn't really on the left, and sometimes he was up front. But it seems like he's now, look, you're out on the left.
You're a left winger.
And Ozil, you're a number 10.
Yeah.
You're a number 10. And like, it seems like he's just sort of finding his role. Because again, he was another one, sometimes out on the left, sometimes on the right. We've seen him several games in a row now in the middle, and like, some of the stuff he's playing at the moment is just absolutely sublime.
I mean,
he probably should have scored at the weekend.
Ozil now is, I think, in the last 7 games, he's had an assist or a goal in every single game.
He needs to do it for a whole season, though.
Yeah, but I mean, this is as consistent as he's been for Arsenal.
Yeah, he needs to end up with like 10 goals and like 15 assists.
He looks, if he keeps on his form and doesn't pick up an injury, which touch wood, he doesn't get an Arsenal injury, he looks like he could be just a player that we shape this team around, and the whole creativity of the team goes through Ozil.
Yeah, and how old is he? Like 24?
Something obscene where he should be like 10 years older.
But yeah, and Joel Campbell, do you think he's going to get a few more games?
I hope so. He might have to. We don't have many more options. For the next 2 or 3 weeks until after the international break, we seem to be using that as a yardstick at the moment. I think a lot of our players will come back after the international break.
Yeah.
But, you know, he'll get the next 2 or 3 games definitely starting just simply because of a lack of options. You know, we're bringing young players off the bench to give our, you know, Ozil came off with 5 or 10 minutes to go.
It would be nice if he did have, you know, 3 or 4 good games,
yeah.
and then people did start to get back. Wenger just said, no, you got to earn your place back. And
yeah.
he's in that spot.
I hope so, because he looked really good for Costa Rica in the World Cup. Yeah. And every time I've seen him play for Costa Rica, he looks like...
smashed us to pieces.
Yeah, he looks really, really good. I don't think it's his natural position, but I think he's easily capable of playing there. He's got great personal skills. He's fast. He's quite physical. And he knows where the goal is. His finish for his goal was actually, considering he hasn't seen much football this season, was really calm. His first touch was great, and he just slotted it with his left foot.
So I've got one to throw out here, like something that I've spotted this season, and I don't know if it's just a bit of form or if it's a trend. Ashley Williams, I'm not rating him at all this season. Last season, I thought, you know, Arsenal were a bit mad for not going in for him. And a number of other teams who could have done with like a absolutely solid third choice or you know, pushing for the first team. He's you know, the thing we say about Terry, which is like where he's just lunging around a lot, which sort of shows that he's a bit off the pace. I'm starting to spot Williams doing that as well.
Ashley Williams had...
because he's 31 now?
Yeah, but I know he had an injury. He came to one of the Wales camps with an injury.
Right.
And it was a potentially... not a long-term injury, but potentially like niggly injury.
Right.
And he made...
which you don't need. Like.
Yeah. And I've got a feeling it was either his back or his hamstring, which again, at that age as a centre-back, those things tend to go.
Yeah.
And he made it through one of the games.
Because he's obviously come all the way up through the leagues.
Yeah.
And he peaked and, you know, about 28, which you'd expect him to do.
Yeah.
And then I wonder, maybe I'm just being harsh and I don't want, you know, it's just something that I kind of had noticed and I just wanted to point out. Like, I wonder if he's... he could be about to fall off a cliff. And I hope not, because I think he's a really classy player. And I think he started
the season well. I wonder if the sheer amount of games he's been playing, because there's been a lot of Welsh qualifiers and a lot of Welsh friendlies that he's ended up playing in because we've wanted to win all of them. And he's not had an injury. And I almost think he's played a lot of minutes already. So I wonder if... I don't know. He'll definitely play the next 2 Wales friendlies. So I don't know if he's going to get any rest time.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess there's a few nil nils and things. I don't really want to talk about Palace, Man United. You got anything you want to talk about there?
Not particularly. I wonder. I think Man U are kind of flattering to deceive a little bit. I think the amount of minutes they haven't scored in now is something outrageous. Like 250. I think
they've drawn the last games.
It's
three
last
games,
three games nil nil. For the quality they've got in their team. Again, they started Martial out left when he's quite obviously an out and out striker. And they seem to be hamstrung by the fact that he feels like he has to play Wayne Rooney. And I wonder whether for the benefit of the United team, whether dropping Rooney, or however unpopular it would be, and having a more dynamic attacking kind of four of, you know, Martial, Depay, Mata and Herrera would be a bit more...
I'm just not convinced the problem is with Rooney.
I don't know. He doesn't really seem to be doing anything. He's not influencing the games at all.
Obviously, there's that Scholes comment. And Scholes, like, while he's my all-time favourite player, he can be a bit of a tool at times with the things he says.
But I think he likes to have a headline.
Yeah, but he was saying, like, he was at the game, the last game, and he was saying, there's nothing wrong with Rooney. Like, his movement and that is all looking good. It's just he's not getting the service that he had been getting in the teams when I was playing. Yeah, another 0-0.
Another 0-0. Good result for Palace.
I think they're what, second or third? Like, yeah. It's not, you know, they're ticking along.
I think Palace would be quite happy with that.
Yeah.
I know it's a slightly out of form Man U, but still Man U coming to Selhurst Park.
Yeah.
I doubt they would have wanted more than a draw, or doubt they would have expected more than a draw out of that.
Mm. Kabay could have scored again.
Yeah, he seems to be doing that. He seems to be getting in positions where he can score.
In the box a lot.
And he doesn't perhaps convert as much as he should. He
scores a lot of pens, though. And then I guess probably the only other game we need to talk about is Man City Norwich.
Noisy neighbours.
A pretty good win for Man City, all things considered. I mean, Norwich didn't really deserve
to be in with the shout. They were kind of playing, you know, very away team against a much better.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Playing on the break, and obviously they got the pace up front with Jerome and Jarvis, and they played their game plan against, you know, a weaker team against a stronger opposition that you wouldn't necessarily expect them to get anything from. But once, like, Joe Hart obviously had a howler and dropped the ball, and Jerome did really well, I thought. I don't think enough have made of that. Like, he was,
no, it's been more focused on Hart's howler than Jerome's.
It would be very easy to say, very easy for Jerome not to have taken that chance and be right in there and just expecting it, because he's probably done that 50 games in a row and not got anything for it. So I think, you know, well played. It was a really good finish, and it just struck me how unusual it is for us to talk about Hart errors these days.
Yeah,
like, it really has knocked them out of his game.
No, not for a couple of seasons now. I can't remember one where he's had a big mistake in a game that's really cost him anything, and luckily it didn't cost him this time. I think City have, it sounds a stupid thing to say, but they've done well to get by without Silva and Aguero so far. I know if you look at their team, it's not exactly missing money players.
Yeah, but they're two of the best players in the world.
They're two of the best players in the world. And the fact that they're still picking up wins and not losing that many points when they, you know, the Manchester derby last weekend, they managed to kind of ride that out without a lot of their best players.
Yeah.
And they didn't start Sterling in this game. He had an injury. So
I think Sterling dived.
Really?
For the pen.
Yeah, I think so.
I think, well, he bought it. He certainly bought it.
He knew. It's one of those ones where I think you know what's going to happen and kind of preempt it.
Yeah. I think when the ref blew, it was like a second delay while I was thinking about it. And I thought, he's going to book him. And I wouldn't have been outraged if he had, but he obviously gave the pen. In fact, I think I was probably more outraged that he gave the pen, which tells you that I think it obviously was a dive. But yeah, very good result for City to get back. Belting header from Otamendi. I love to see that.
He's an odd shape for a centre-back. He's not particularly tall, or he doesn't look particularly tall.
Well, let's see. So Richard Wright was 6'2", by the way. Yeah. I don't know if I mentioned that, but I'm going to have a
look. But he looks like an absolute beast of a player. He looks like a South American centre-back. You know, he looks like a bit of a Lucio kind of character where you wouldn't want to fight him in a street fight, guaranteed.
I wouldn't want to fight anyone in a street fight.
I think I'd take Ander Herrera in a street fight.
6 foot.
Yeah, so he's not exactly a big centre-back.
Fair.
Yeah.
I've got nothing to come back with.
He looks really good, and they seem to have got into a position now, City, where they've got four quite good centre-backs. You know, you look at that, and De Michaelis and Mangala are not in that team.
Yeah.
Both of which have played this season and not looked bad.
I always say, to win a league, you need four top-class centre-backs.
You need four centre-backs and at least three strikers.
Yeah. But I think, obviously, Kolarov then missed the penalty, but it didn't matter at the end, and they kind of got through. And it sounds like a nondescript game, but actually, it looks like, you know, Norwich had almost played the perfect game plan, and then they just got sucker punched right at the end. But.
Yeah, I think with the international break coming up, and I think it's going to be the next couple of weeks or the next week will be very, very important for these teams. I think we're going to see who, you know, moving forward, there's going to be a couple of Champions League games in between, but I think the next round of league games will be really
important.
Is it
Champions League this week? Yeah, okay.
And then you've got Chelsea, I know, have got to go away to Stoke, which again, it's not a particularly
Stoke are pretty ropey at the moment.
But they've got Shawcross back.
Yeah, you love Shawcross.
I do love Shawcross. He makes such a big difference to that team.
Well, not this week.
And then there's a big gap for international week. So, you know, just to go back to Chelsea, they're probably the team in most dire straits in the league at the moment.
Yeah, probably.
They've got two games, a home to Dynamo Kiev and then away to Stoke before a big, you know, 2 week break for internationals. You're thinking they've got to get something out of that Stoke game, otherwise.
Well, they need something out of the other game as well.
Yes, yeah,
they're they can still go through.
Yeah, definitely. But I think they'll be more worried about going to Stoke and thinking if they can win at Stoke and go into the international break where they can kind of regroup a little bit. But if they lose or draw at Stoke, again, just a world of trouble coming towards what will be the end of November then.
Mm. All right, anyway, cool.
That's for another time.
That is for another time. And I think this podcast has had its time, so I'll probably leave it there. Good to see you again, buddy. And we'll be back next week.
Adios.
Cheers.